Greetings, listeners. Welcome to Peace Bound and Down, a Wonder Woman podcast brought to you by the Fire and Water Podcast Network. On this show, we discuss stellar runs of Wonder Woman, beginning with the best run of all time, the George Perez written and drawn issues of Wonder Woman from his monumental reinvention of the character in 1987. Now, on each episode, we have a special guest from the larger podcasting community to help me dive into the issue. And I'm super excited. I was going to be snarky or silly, but I just can't. I love this guy too much. I'm super excited for today's guest because he's just not only one of my favorite podcasters, he's legitimately one of my favorite people on the planet. Those of you who have the pleasure of knowing him know he's just the most wonderfully nice, genuine person ever, which is interesting considering he comes from Oklahoma. But please help me welcome Clinton Robison to the show. Clinton, how you doing?
I'm good. I think you've kind of oversold me here, Sean, but I'm good.
Genuinely, you are one of the people in our podcasting community that when your name comes up, everybody immediately starts chiming in about how wonderful you are. So, you know, your ears must be burning all the time.
Everyone quakes in fear. Hoping that I won't show up. Yes.
That you won't escape the dungeon from the Longbox Crusade. No, well, I'm so glad you're here, man. We've recorded together a bunch over the years on your wonderful shows, on my shows, but this is the first time I've had you on for the Wonder Woman show. So thanks for being here. And folks, before we begin, the Fire and Water Podcast Network brings hours of amazing content to the airwaves each month, and we needed some help running the network and hosting our show, so we started a Patreon. At certain tiers of support, you can sponsor a show, and I'd like to thank Martin Gray and Brett Young for choosing to sponsor Peace Bound and Down. If you're interested in joining our Patreon, please visit patreon.com/Fire and Water Podcast Network. So, Clinton, we start every episode with the same question for our guests. How'd you discover Diana of Themyscira? How'd you discover Wonder Woman?
Wait, this is a Wonder Woman podcast? I thought this was a Wonder Man podcast.
Hey, actually, that might be more popular considering he's getting his own show coming. That might have been a smarter move on my part. But you know what would have ended that show immediately for listeners for me is my love of the green costume with the rocket pack on the back from West Coast Avengers. Look, the red Nehru jacket costume is the best. It's unassailable. But I love the ugly green costume for Wonder Woman. So that would have immediately lost me all listeners.
What, am I like the only one that prefers tank top Wonder Man?
Oh, really? With the mullet?
Yeah.
Oh, I mean, that is a look.
And the red jacket is when he's palling around with beasts. So that's obviously the best era. But Anyway, I've derailed us already.
So Wonder Woman, how'd you discover Wonder Woman?
Well, as you know, I'm slightly younger than you, so
which you remind me of every time.
Indeed. So Wonder Woman was pretty much just in the general zeitgeist. I probably first encountered her on Super Friends. As far as the comics go, I actually, my first Wonder Woman comics were like 3 for $1 specials from some outlet store.
Oh, nice.
Two of which were part of this story arc.
Oh, awesome.
Not this issue, though.
I mean, that would have been too serendipitous.
Yeah, it was like part of the challenge. 1-3 and then issue 18 or something. And believe you me, I was confused because I'm like, who is this person? You know, I'm trying to stay spoiler free here. You know, who is this person mentioned on the cover and why should I care about them?
It's a legitimate question. So the 3 for $1 comics, were they like bin kind of dive comics, or were they in the like plastic, like you used to be able to get at like Walmart and places like that where you could get 3 comics for $1 and you could see the cover of the front one and maybe the cover of the back one, but you had no idea what you know, who Lucky Pierre was in the middle. Was it one of those?
First of all, kudos for you using Lucky Pierre. I had to explain that to a professor one time. No, they were actually on a spinner rack because there were like the 3 Wonder Woman issues and 3 Byrne era Superman issues.
Oh, nice.
Unfortunately, you know, they all had the nice little price tag sticker right on the front, you know, labeled 3 for $1. So it was like, well, you know, suffer through that or rip your cover.
I can forgive folks from the 80s for that, right? Like I can forgive folks who just didn't know better, but I have legitimately been in places bin diving and seeing that done now, like, where I'm like, did you put a price sticker directly on this comic? And they're like, yeah. And I'm like, okay, well, like, that sucks, because now I have to find a way to remove it, or I'm just not buying it, because it's going to bug me because I'm OCD about my comic collection. And so, again, I could forgive it in older comics where people didn't know, but doing it today, you just burn in hell. Like, it's a total sin.
Well, you know, it's one thing when it's three for a dollar, or, you know, a quarter or whatever. Mm-hmm. And something else entirely when somebody's like, oh, $10.
Oh, I know. It's so ridiculous.
Like, it ain't worth 10 cents now.
Yeah, I those moments where you go somewhere that doesn't normally sell comics, but they'll have like a little batch of them, and you could tell they went online and were like, oh, how much is this comic book? And they're like, oh, $8. And you're like, yeah, $8 pristine, but your comic, you know, your version looks like it, you know, was written hard and put away wet. Like, there's this isn't worth anything. What are you doing?
Oh, yeah, I have a whole story about that one, but that might derail us again.
So three for a dollar comics is great, and the fact that you got some Challenge of the Gods comics is pretty awesome too. This is a wonderful arc. Speaking of the issue and the Challenge of the Gods, today we will be jumping into Wonder Woman volume 2 issue 11, which was released in December of 1987. The issue, titled Torment, is penciled, well, the layouts anyway, and plotted by George Perez, scripted by Len Wein. It's got finished art by Bruce Patterson. It's lettered by John Costanza, colored by Carl Gafford, and edited by the legendary Karen Berger. And it's a second part of a great arc, and we're going to have a lot to talk about. But as always, Clinton, before we jump into the issue itself, every episode opens with a fun segment I like to call the Lasso of Truth, where you and I both grab Diana's golden lasso and tell some sort of silly, fun truth about ourselves. So since you're the guest, why don't you start us off?
Okay, so since it's you and you're show full of truth, I will tell a story that probably nobody on the network knows, probably nobody else in our podcasting sphere knows. Ooh. And in a roundabout way, it kind of revolves around the helmet of Harry. I can't talk today, Sean. The helmet of Hermes. Mercury, you know, that guy.
Yeah. Okay, I'm curious.
Okay, so Let's set the scene. Sicily, 1921. No. America, 2017. As you may or may not be aware, I'm a bit of a geek. You know, one might even say nerdish. And I have been known in the past and present and probably future to do a little cosplay now and again.
Oh, nice.
So, on attending a convention in 2017, I dressed as none other than Jay Garrick. There was a gentleman there by the name of Ijen Chang who was taking pictures for a book, Cosplay in America, Volume 2. Yours truly just so happens to be on page 22.
Oh, that's awesome. Okay, looking this book. I'm looking the book up, by the way.
That's about $45. Although you can get it on library loan if you really want.
Okay, well, you've got to tell us more about this. So how did you, like, what did he, see you? Did he grab you and say he wants you in the book? How did it go?
Well, I was a fan of his first book. You know, Ijen and I had been corresponding on social media, and, you know, one of those, like, hey, you know, if I run into you, I wouldn't mind, you know, getting a few photos. And he's like, yeah, sure, why not? I'm planning on taking pictures of, you know, dozens of people, and we'll see what makes the book and what doesn't. Funnily enough, like, we got to the hotel at the same time. Like, he's unloading all his camera equipment and stuff, and we're unloading the luggage and whatever. And it's just like, hey, yeah, Ijen, yeah, hi. You know, back and forth and chit-chat, help him carry stuff around. A couple of days later, you know, he's still taking pictures. And I'm like, yeah, why not do some photos? Think, you know, never once thinking I'm actually going to be in a book. I was just like, yeah, you know, cool. Take some pictures. You know, I'd love to see them how they turn out. And then, like, you know, a month, 2 months later, he shoots me an email. Hey, I need you to sign the release so I can put this in the book. And I'm like, the what now? Okay.
That is awesome. So you have to describe how'd you make the hat? Like, the hat's the key part here. What'd you do for the World War I style hat?
The hat, you know, I'm one of those, you know, looks like the guy on National Lampoon's spring break or summer vacation or whatever it is, where the guy that's got the whole Kirk Spock set up in his basement, that kind of nerd. So I just made it with, like, an old kitchen bowl and some cardboard.
Oh, that's smart. Okay.
You know, it's very rudimentary. You can tell looking at the picture that it is just jank.
That's what makes it cool, though. And then did you do like a red t-shirt and with a lightning strike, or what'd you do?
Yep.
Did you do a jacket?
Nope. You know, red shirt painted on the lightning bolt. You know, the Flash TV series wasn't really even like, was it a thing then? Yeah, the first couple seasons might have been going then.
Yeah, by that point, I think they were.
Yeah, but I don't think Jay had been really introduced, like, with that modern mm-hmm. jacket look. Nope.
Okay, so most important question. Pants. Did you do... How'd you do the blue...
Like, just what, blue jeans.
Okay, just blue jeans.
Yeah.
Because I'm looking at... Because I'm desperately trying to find you. I'm looking at all the different Jay Garrick cosplays from around that era, and some of them are, like, you know, blue jeans, which look good. And then some of the guys have, like... skin tight blue lycra and or spandex or something. And I was really hoping that was going to be your answer, because I was going to ask you the question I have and have never dared to ask all cosplayers, which is, what do you do with your wiener? Like, I just don't, like, I don't.
If you are wise and considerate, you wear a dance belt.
Oh, wait, a what?
It's called a dancer's belt.
Oh my God, please tell me you dance.
No, but it is a thing to help tuck.
Okay.
And you will notice quite often that Spider-Man and Deadpool cosplayers very often do not wear one.
Right. And this is so not where this show is supposed to go. This episode was supposed to go. But one of the things I really appreciate about Alex Ross, you know, he uses live models and he paints them, and he paints them as they appear, and you're like, okay, yeah, in a skin tight costume, like, you would have that, you would have a bulge. And some of his characters are painted in such detail you can tell what religion they are, and you know, and it's it's interesting. But I've always kind of wondered that about cosplayers, and I didn't know there was like a dancer. Okay, that's interesting. That's really funny. So so for those, anybody who made it through that little segment and is still listening, sorry about that. I know that was a bizarre aside, but it is legitimately something I've thought about when I've seen cosplayers, because I'm like, you know, just, I don't know. It just, you think about it, right? So Clinton, mine is not as cool as yours on any stretch, but I'm going to do something. This has actually happened in quite a few episodes. I had a Lasso of Truth moment prepared, but yours has inspired me and reminded me of a different, but a story in a similar vein. So my junior year of high school, I go to a really big school. There's about 3,800 kids at my school. In fact, my senior class was so large, they had to get a crane to take our senior photo of the whole class together. And it's two huge photos pieced together. I don't have it anymore, but I remember seeing it. But anyway, senior prom comes up, junior senior prom, and I'm going with the girl that I'm dating at the time. You know, my first prom, her first prom, everything's going to be fun. We're going with another couple. I'll get to them in a minute. But we get to the venue, and there's this long line to go through photos. And most of us have never been to a prom before, so we don't know that this is unusual. That, like, usually with prom, the photo thing is kind of off to the side. You can choose to do it. You don't have to do it. For some reason, this one was herding you sort of through the entrance to the photos. And all along the wall where everybody's waiting in line are mirrors with, like, I don't know, like, various types of makeup and or hairspray or combs or whatever. And we're all like, oh, okay, I guess this is just so we look good. So, you know, you're standing there, you're a teenager, right? You've never seen a mirror, you're not going to stop and look in. So we're all kind of standing there, and we're looking at the mirrors, and we're having conversations, and we're like, you know, combing our hair or fixing something and everything. And then we get to the photos, and you do the photos, and then you go through. Well, about halfway through the dance, the prom, they announce that whole setup was part of the relaunch of Candid Camera. Well, none of us had ever heard of Candid Camera before, right? We're teenagers, but they're like, hey, there was this show. They would plant cameras. They would play tricks on people, and they would get their reactions. This, literally all of you may be on a TV show. And so, of course, you know, we're all dumb teens. Everybody's like, oh, yeah. So then we're all trying to remember what we say. And my girlfriend, April, like, smacks me on the shoulder. And I go, what? And she goes, you're definitely going to be on TV. And I go, oh, I go, why? I go, I don't, what do you mean? What do you mean? She goes, do you remember the whole, oh my God, I'm glad this mirror's here. I have a giant booger moment that you had. And I go, wait, what? And so apparently I discovered, I think the exact term I used was a bat in the belfry, and had a giant booger. And because I was a dumb, obnoxious teen, instead of being like discreet and blowing my nose, I was like, oh my God, April, look at this giant booger. It would have been in the photo. And she was like, you're disgusting. And then my, you know, friends are next to me and they're like, oh, keep it for the photo. And then we have this like heated debate about whether or not to keep it. She's yelling at me saying, you're not ruining my prom photos. And I'm like, you won't even see it. She's like, I'll know it's there. So we have this whole crazy, dumb sitcom conversation and gets caught on film. Well, they reach out. I don't know, maybe a month later, and they ask for a release. They're like, hey, you know, we want to, and I very thankfully have two really smart older sisters. And my one of my older sisters, I tell her about it, and I tell her about why they probably selected me. And she goes, hey, that sounds funny. She goes, but do you really want that on TV, like, forever? And I was like, what? And she's like, yeah. She's like, what if it's like a really funny thing and it just gets replayed like randomly? I mean, this is obviously before the internet, so we didn't even know that. But she's like, do you really want that out there? Like, I don't, she's like, what if you look bad? What if you look dumb? What if you said something more than, what if what they want to release is for something other than that? What if you said something and it's not something you would have approved? She's like, they're not even showing you what they're going to use. She's like, I'd say no to this. And thankfully I listened to my older sister and said no, because I otherwise might be a meme today talking about the great booger debate of the early 90s prom setting. So you and I, that's both of our brief, you know, flickering encounters with potential stardom. But I do have a favor to ask. You have to send me a photo. You have to take a photo of that, or if you have a photo of it, and you really have to send it to me, because I need to see you as Jay Garrick.
That's fine.
Oh my God, that's so awesome. All right. So that brings us to the close of A Lasso of Truth. Let's get to the issue itself. So again, this is Wonder Woman Volume 2, Issue 11. And the issue is part two of the Challenge of the Gods arc. And in this issue, Diana has been challenged by the gods to descend into the forbidden hellish realm under Paradise Island to discover her destiny and defeat a series of challenges put forward by the gods. In this particular issue, Diana battles and defeats the Hydra, fights and seemingly kills Echidna, mother of demons, and is thrown into a meeting with the woman for whom she is named Diana. Now, during her travails, her mother, Hippolyta, has cast aside her obligations to the gods as queen of the Amazons and embraced her role as mother and is ridden off to enter the forbidden pit to help her daughter. But her friend and general, Philippus, does not believe this is the right choice and tries to intervene. While all this is occurring, in Olympus, the gods are watching, including Pan, who reveals he's keeping a secret from the gods. And while they don't reveal what that secret is in the issue, the Millennium Banner on the cover kind of hints to you what's probably to come. And while all of this is happening, Steve Trevor has traveled to Oklahoma to see his father, but his father has passed away while Steve was in transit, because Oklahoma is where things go to die.
Funny, because it's true.
Oh, Clinton, I was so happy when I put that note in. It was so awesome. I was like, oh my God, I really hope he reads the notes. So, Clinton, this issue has a pretty dramatic cover. Why don't you describe it for the listeners?
Well, before we get into the cover, Sean, I have a bit of a secret question for you.
Oh, you're coming in hot. Okay, awesome. Yes, please.
Okay, so a wiser man than me once said that there are three plots. A man goes on a journey, a stranger comes to town, and Godzilla versus Mega Shark. So, in your opinion, which one of those is this?
Okay, that's a good one. So this is definitely a protagonist goes on a journey, right? It's got a little bit of the other two in that the stranger that comes to town, though not a stranger, would be Zeus, who his coming to Paradise Island triggers this whole thing. But it's Diana going on a journey, and then, you know, she's fighting the Hydra, so the Godzilla thing is apt. But yeah, it's kind of all three in one. But it is one of the reasons I love this arc in particular, is because it's leaning heavily into the quest narrative, you know, that is in every mythology. I mean, read Joseph Campbell, it's in every mythology. Mm-hmm. But in particular, it's in Greek mythology. And I love the, you know, that's where I live. I mean, there's probably not a single comic book collector or D&D player who doesn't live for quests, right? And as you get older, for side quests and that take you away from the quest often. But still, I think it's all three. What about you?
Oh, definitely all three. I mean, how could it not be?
I mean, the Godzilla part was especially apt, man, because fighting the Hydra right off the start, kind of a bold choice. So we jump into the issue, or before we jump into the issue, Clinton, tell us about the cover.
Okay, so we have Diana, deep in the bowels of Themyscira, looking rather shocked and surprised at a shadowy figure hanging up in a spiderweb. Okay, honestly, this may be about the third or fourth ranked of the covers in this storyline.
Mm-hmm.
But that's also like saying a plain Oreo compared to a double stuffed Oreo is, you know, severely lacking. You know, it's hardly diminishing returns. Perez is still on his A game, and the cover draws you in because obviously you want to know what's happening and why.
Yeah, it is a beautiful cover. You're dead on. It's not even in the top, I don't know, probably 20 covers of Perez's run in this book, but it is striking. I love the color because I want to give a shout out to either, it's either Carl Gafford or Tatiana Wood.
Oh yeah, that green is great.
Yeah, the green of the spider web. So it's Diana's sort of down camera, looking up in shock and horror, and we have everything sort of black. There's a great use of negative space. And there's a silhouette, it's a spider web, and it's green, an eerie, sickly green light behind it. And you've got an outline of somebody caught in the spider web looking desiccated and dead, like as if they've, you know, it's too late, as if Diana's arrived too late. Now, we can't see who it is because the silhouette's all in black. And then there's a silhouette of like these bat-like creatures flying around it. So it's very Lord of the Rings. I mean, this is, or The Hobbit. I mean, this is very like, you know, Bilbo encountering the giant spider in the cave, but there's a reason that works. I mean, caves are primal fear pockets, you know, for humans for a reason. And so it's a really good cover. And for any other 10 comic book artists, this would be their crowning achievement. But for Perez, it's like, yeah, it's good. You know, not his best. It's so funny. But I do want to highlight one other thing. In the bottom corner, in the little corner box on the bottom, says Millennium is coming. So we had a Millennium banner on the last issue. We had a hint of one. We've got the hint of it here. And for those of us who know Millennium, it really has landed in this series already. So we're going to talk about it as if this were a crossover, a little bit of a crossover issue coming up. But yeah, the color is really carrying the day on this cover. I love it too. So really good cover. And then we jump in and we get a fun splash page sort of recap of what's happening. It's the gods are above, sitting looking down at Diana fighting the Hydra and watching, and we get just a quick recap of like, okay, here's where Diana's at, here's why this is happening. And it's a beautiful splash page. I mean, it's a beautiful recap page, and Perez does a great job of showing Zeus sort of fretting, and which is interesting because this whole thing is his fault, except you've got Pan whispering in his ear like worm tongue, you know. And then you've got Diana fighting the Hydra. The one thing I do want to say is when you flip the page, you get a two-page sort of spread, and the gods are all chatting about, like, you know, do you think she can do this? The female gods and some of the male gods who are invested with Diana are like, they're very worried about her. They want her to be successful. They don't want her to die. Zeus is sort of like, I don't think she can beat the Hydra, and Pan's chirping in his ear. And at the bottom half of the page, it says Fire and Torment. And oh, which is the title. I screwed up the title earlier. It's not Torment. It's Fire and Torment. It's Diana with a shield blocking a flaming burp from the Hydra, for lack of a better term. This is, and this is no disrespect, Clinton, but I have a question for you.
Mm-hmm.
I love Perez. He's a favorite artist of all time. Not even just comic book artist, favorite artist of all time. And in this issue, they make it very clear that he's layouts and Bruce Patterson is finished art. And for the most part, that's okay. Patterson is a gifted inker. And I 9 out of 10 times, it's all really smooth. This is the one point where I stopped and went, oh, that's more Patterson than Perez. Because the way he draws the Hydra on the bottom right part of the page looks like it's right out of the Dungeons & Dragons cartoon show in the 80s. Like, I feel like Venger is standing behind it, you know, and Eric is, you know, Danny, Ralph Mouth, who paid Danny?
Donnie Most.
Donnie Most. I knew you would know this. Donnie Most is standing, you know, is holding his shield, quivering. It looks like it's, I mean, it's just not Perez standard. It feels more like Sight of Van. So, like, did you notice that too, or did you have a moment where you're like, oh yeah, this isn't full Perez?
Yeah, I mean, it. I know it's weird, but it's like something to do with the mouths.
Yeah.
I can't explain it. I don't have the artist's vernacular, but yeah, it's just something about it. That and Diana's hair. If you ever want to know if Perez drew the page, you just look at Wonder Woman's hair.
It's similar to how you know in McFarlane's Spider-Man. You look at the spaghetti webbing. Mm-hmm. And it's Perez's, you know, Perez is like, oh, she's Greek. Her hair's curly. You know, it's going to be curly. And so there are moments like in the next, while she's fighting the Hydra, there's a panel on page 6 that zeroes in on her face. And clearly Perez drew this one because it's got the Perez eyes, the Perez mouth. But you're right. That is sort of where you notice the difference. It reminds me a little bit of, and I love Gary Frank. Gary Frank is an amazing comic book artist. But early in his career, he struggled with what another podcaster called pretty aptly dead eye, where like just his character's eyes, for some reason, on the page, just translated as kind of like just dead. And there was a creep, there was like an uncanny valley to it. It was like watching Polar Express, and you're like, I hear Tom Hanks' voice, but I see a murdering train conductor, you know, like I don't, yeah, something's not jiving here. So yeah, so there's a little bit, the art's still wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
Storytelling's great. Patterson is a gifted artist in his own right. It's just, you know, filling in for Perez is like, you know, being asked to fill in for Cal Ripken Jr. Like you're just, it's not going to happen. Like it just, you know.
Now, before we move on from this, you mentioned Diana's shield and, you know, I really like Diana's armored look here.
Uh-huh.
So I have another secret question.
Oh, my God. You're bringing the heat.
Yeah, we cannot deny that this is a wonderful look for Wonder Woman. No pun intended. You know, the Greek armored look. But I want to know, what is another favorite armored up look from comics that you...
Oh, Clinton Robinson. You are bringing the heat, man. That is a freaking awesome question because... may I introduce you to the 90s? Like, basically, this is what makes this such a great secret question, Clinton, is one, it's unexpected. And two, there is such a plethora of choice. I mean, you know, I'm thinking Web of Spider-Man, I think it's 100, the spider art, like the bejeweled diamond spider armor. I've never read that comic. I know the cover, and it'll pop up every once in a while in like craziest Spider-Man costumes. I call it his Liberace costume, or Donna Summer costume. It's basically like a disco chandelier. Mm-hmm. So it's not one of my favorites, but it's one of the ones I think about. So I'm going to cheat a little bit. I hope that's okay. I'm going to do a favorite and a least favorite. So my least favorite is from a book, Solo Avengers, which launched in the late 80s. It was capitalizing on the popularity of the Avengers, the West Coast Avengers, and Hawkeye. And basically, they wanted Hawkeye to have his own comic book. They didn't maybe fully trust he could lead it, even though obviously he can because he's one of the best characters ever. And the Mark Gruenwald 4-issue Hawkeye miniseries from the 80s is the greatest miniseries of all time. I'm just going to put that out there. But he's Solo Avengers. It was a split book. First half was Hawkeye's solo adventures. Second half would be a solo adventure of another Avenger. And it was a great way to spotlight characters like Mockingbird or Firebird or Black Widow, who wasn't really super present at the time. Well, at about 24, 25 issues into this book, they are scrambling for a storyline for Hawkeye, and they have him get shot by a gang, though it's like a gang. It's like the artist, I remember the artist, it might have been Herb Trimpe, but the artist basically watched an episode of Barney Miller and was like, this is what gangs look like. You know, like this is what street toughs look like. And it looks like the Sweat Hogs, like from Welcome Back Cotton. I mean, it's so out of date. It's so ridiculous. And he gets shot and then he dons a new costume, which is basically like an armored costume. And you're like, oh, that's cool. For the lithe bow and arrow guy who relies on his agility to be a superhero. So that was my least favorite. My favorite, and this is going to be probably controversial, is the Daredevil black armored costume. I don't love that era of Daredevil necessarily. I mean, for a character who in his DNA is overly maudlin, even that era like is so dark and depressing that like I don't even know. Like it needs meds. That whole era.
You're talking about like the BMX armor.
Yes. Daredevil. Yeah. The DJ Chester, Scott McDaniel era, you know, late 90s era.
I love that era.
The stories are not my favorite,
No, but I really love.
Yeah, the look is chef's kiss. It's awesome. So what about you?
If we're going with the least favorite, I'm just going to throw the Captain America
exosuit
thing out there because really?
Yeah.
But for a favorite, man, you almost swayed me with Daredevil there. But I'm going to stick to my guns. And I even almost said the Green Lantern look from Kingdom Come. But
ooh.
I have to go with Thor's battle armor from Simonson era.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, you win. There's no winning secret questions, but you win. the Walt Simonson and then also Sal Buscema. And that storyline is so great, right? Hela has cursed him so that he cannot die, but he also is not healing from injuries. So he is literally like a bag of broken bones and has to don this armor just to hold his body together. And it's, that's a great choice, man. That's a really, really good choice. And then also your least favorite's great. That Fighting Chance arc at the end of Grunwald's run. Rest in peace, Mark Grunwald. You were one of the greats, but you stayed on at Captain America maybe 5 years too long, and then that last arc shows it.
You want a weird piece of comic book trivia?
Yeah.
Mark Grunwald died on my birthday.
Did he really?
Yes.
That's really interesting because I've always held you responsible for his death in the back of my mind.
Yeah. See, like, you know, as far as anytime somebody talks about, you know, I share a birthday with this celebrity. I share a birthday with this celebrity. I'm like, well, my birthday killed people.
So my wife, her 21st birthday was the day Princess Diana died. And she goes to this bar with her sister. They go out to have, you know, a little fun and some friends. And everybody's just super maudlin because Princess Diana's died. And my wife, being a bratty 21-year-old, is like, what the hell? You didn't even know her. It's my birthday. We need to celebrate. And now, like, in retrospect, she's like, oh, I was a piece of trash. She's like, I was a piece of human garbage. She's like, I spent my entire birthday cursing Princess Diana for dying on it and coloring the mood. And I'm like, yeah, we're all trash people in our early 20s, you know. It just part for the course. That was a great question, man. Actually, you're bringing the heat. These are some rock star secret questions. So Diana's in the armor. She's fighting the Hydra. He's firing these, you know, fiery blasts at her. She realizes, I can't cut his head off. Another one will grow to take its place. So she uses the magic lasso to tie him, to bind him. All his sort of heads, or I guess I'm assuming gender, to tie their heads together. And then breaks out a bow and arrow. Where I was like, what? Where did that come from? Like, this is great. Like, I love when they let a character use new or interesting weapons than they usually do. And this is not a secret question I prepared at all, but like, do you have an example of another character who's kind of most associated with one kind of weapon and a time when they use another that you like?
Ooh.
That's an impromptu secret question. That one just, I'll go first since I asked it. I have two. One, I'm just in a Hawkeye kind of mood, I guess.
That's kind of where I was thinking.
Okay, yeah, when he's Ronin.
Mm-hmm.
So he's got the nunchucks, and he's more of like a fist, kind of a fisticuffs guy, and he uses swords. And I don't think he uses a bow and arrow at all when he's Ronin. So that's a really interesting one. And then you brought up Thor. So I like when they give Thor, you know, like Schmirgenbirgen or whatever that axe is called. I don't remember the exact name of it. Schmirgenbirgenbirgen sounds great. Or, you know, they give him an axe, or they give him, you know, some sort of other like magical Asgardian weapon. I always think that's really cool because, you know, Mjolnir is great, but like we've got 50, 60 years of Mjolnir. It's kind of cool to see him wielding something else.
Yeah. Oh gosh, man. Those are good choices. Like I said, my first thought was Hawkeye doing stuff as Ronin, but I'm going to just flat out say when Batman gets to fence every so often.
Oh, nice.
You know, especially that first Ra's al Ghul story.
Uh-huh.
Where, you know, it ends up with them having the sword duel in the desert and everything. Like
Batman and Ra's al Ghul sword fighting in the desert sounds like a premise of a porn, but it's actually one of the great stories of all time. Neil Adams.
Well, especially, you know, Denny since O'Neil. that's where we get bare-chested Batman.
Oh, bare-chested Batman in the cowl is like everybody's near gay awakening. There's no getting around that. So Diana fights the Hydra. She binds his heads together. and she's able to fire arrows at his soft underbelly and sort of pull the cave, the caverns, you know, roof, the stalactites and stalagmites and all those fun things down upon him. But she's not going to leave the lasso, right? Like, this is a gift from the gods. So she has to fly up to try to get it. And in getting it, is just nailed by an eruption of fire, falls to the ground, and sleeps because Morpheus, the god of sleep and dreams, is in Olympus watching over and gives her a sort of healing sleep, which is fascinating, right? Because you cannot read DC Comics and hear Morpheus and not think of The Endless from the Sandman series. So it's really funny when he shows up looking like B. Arthur out of the Golden Girls, and you're like, oh, that's not Morpheus. And you're like, also, he's trapped in somebody's dungeon at this time. You know, and there's a little bit of, you know, cross continuity. I think there's a no prize there, but most
did you notice Morpheus's challenge is for her to wake up?
Yeah. He's like, okay. He's like, you know, I'll give her a healing sleep. And then if she wakes up, she can move on. And it's like, that might be the hardest and most real challenge she faces.
Yeah. I'm doomed, Sean. I'm doomed. That's where humanity is just lost.
Yeah. Yeah. I have this fun little ritual in the mornings when I wake up for work where I wake up and I'm still capable of closing my eyes and going back to sleep for like 4 hours. And I go, just do it. Nothing matters. And then I start laughing and then I go, well, you know, I guess paying your house payment and raising your child and, you know, keeping a roof over your head and food, those things matter. And yeah, but I have this fun little moment where I just want to toss it all away for 4 hours of sleep. So Clinton, we're now coming to one of the reasons I'm so excited that you're on this episode. It's a sad story moment, but it's exciting because it hits you literally where you live. So Steve Trevor was reached out to by his family and told that his father was ill. He's got to fly back home to Oklahoma, where he's from, to see his father. And Etta Candy goes with them, and they're planting some nice seeds of this sort of budding relationship between Etta and Steve. They get to the airport. Steve sees his cousin, and he learns that his father's already passed away while he was in transit. And it's doubly sad because his best friend, Colonel Michaelis, died in the earlier arc, and now his father's passed away. But I wanted, Clinton, tell us a little bit about this airport. Do they nail this? Did George and Bruce and Len, did they do their research? Does this feel like home?
As far as the look, I'm not entirely certain. I've never actually seen it, but this is a real airport. It's owned by the city of Enid. It's open to the public. You know, it's not like a, you know, international airport. It's more for puddle jumpers.
Mm-hmm.
And Steve mentions, you know, the time that he lived there with his dad, and as a kid, they would visit mountains. And you're thinking, mountains in Oklahoma? This is bull. No, Steve is probably referring to Gloss Mountain State Park, which is roughly an hour away from Enid. So, yeah.
So, real Perez, landmarks.
Yeah, Perez did some research for this.
Which is really nice. I mean, again, you know, pre-internet, you know, this it's not exactly easy to... I mean, I guess you could pull out an almanac or a you know, map of the states or something. But like, I like that he took the time to get it right. And actually, it leads me to my first secret question of the episode, which is really, really rooted in the fact that this is your home state. So Clinton, in this issue, we get them returning to Oklahoma, and we get Steve mentioning some real landmarks and places that feel real to those who are from that particular area. So in any other comics, do you have a favorite story or moment that's set where you live, set in your home?
Yes. There is an entire story arc of Thor where Asgard hovers above what is roughly Claremore, Oklahoma.
Okay. So in the comics, they call it Broxton. Is Broxton not a real town?
Not to my knowledge. But that doesn't mean anything. That doesn't sound very Oklahoma.
Mm-hmm.
And yet it is.
Oh, it is a real Oklahoma town?
That's awesome. Oh my God, it is.
Look at you learning something from comics. So yeah, tell us about this. Give us the 30,000 foot on this storyline. Because for those of you who aren't familiar with it, it's like an amazing era of Thor.
Yeah. Now it's been a long time since I've read it. So if I have wow, Broxton is way down there, so it's not even anywhere close to Claremore. Sorry.
Is it close to Texas?
Yes.
Okay.
It's much closer to Texas than I am. But then again, most things are. But yeah, best I remember, Asgard, the realm, has been destroyed, but Thor manages to save Asgard, the city,
Basically a city. It's the realm, but it basically appears as a large city.
Yeah, and it's literally just hovering above, you know, the city, town, whatever. Unincorporated community is what Wikipedia calls it, which basically sums up a lot of places. But yeah, it just kind of hovers there. The Asgardians deal with the locals on friendly terms. That's where we get the meme with Volstagg of, you know, coming to the town meeting, and it's like, we heard there would be cake.
I love Volstagg.
Or something along the, what day's festivities are not made better with the addition of cake?
Yeah, that's awesome. I love that era. So it's J. Michael Straczynski and Olivier Coppiel, usually on art. And it's like it's after Civil War. So it's like 2008, 2000, yeah. Around that era.
It's Hero Initiative, all that. Thor was the assigned hero for Oklahoma because of where Asgard was.
Yeah, and it leads into Siege eventually. So it's their stories are so wonderful because, one, the Straczynski era of Thor is really great. It's the best era since Simonson. Simonson's unassailably the best. Jason Aaron's run that came in the later 2000s, I think, is unassailably the second best. It's almost 1B to Simonson's 1A. But Straczynski's right there behind them. And my favorite storyline from that whole era is there is this Asgardian, Kelda, so effectively like a god, and she just meets this like line cook, Bill, this Bill Cobb, this guy that owns a tiny little diner in Broxton, and they fall in love. And he like sacrifices his life to save her. And I mean, it is this awesome... the trope of a story, a beautiful trope of a story of like two people from literally different worlds and different classes and technically, I guess, kind of even different species. But anyway, falling in love and a story of love and sacrifice. And I can't recommend that era enough for anybody who hasn't read it. I'm going to borrow this question for myself, except remove it from Oklahoma. I am from Phoenix, Arizona, and I'm very fortunate in that in 1988 – Roger Stern and Tom Lyle created a new Starman, Earth One Starman.
I was hoping you'd go with that.
Well, there was no Earth One at the time. It was post-crisis, so it was just Earth Prime. But anyway, Will Payton Starman, who is, one of the most underrated characters in the history of comic books. He's got an amazing power set. He was an awesome sort of slice of life, real life superhero guy. Like, he was just he didn't have any tragic backstory. He just got powers in a freak accident and used them to do good. And I love Will Payton Starman. In fact, I wish they would bring him back. They kind of did, but kind of not, about 5 years ago. I love Will Payton. But what I especially love is Tom Lyle. He was from I looked it up at one point. He wasn't from Arizona, but he had lived part of his life in Phoenix. So when he drew Starman, it was actual like Phoenix landmarks. Like there's a mountain. Arizona State University is in Tempe, which is the city literally right next to Phoenix. And there's a mountain there. And I'm putting mountain in air quotes. You can't see it because it's an audio medium. But I'm putting in air quotes because it's just honestly like a big dirt desert hill. But every year, ASU students paint an A on it. And it's called A Mountain, A for ASU. I know, real creative. Shockingly, ASU was, the single biggest party school in the country for decades. And A Mountain is right there. On the cover of, in Starman issue one. So anyway, I love Will Payton Starman. I love when comic books are set somewhere other than New York. And, it's really fun, especially when you're from places, flyover country states like you and me. And they set stuff and, where we live. Like, it'd be nice to look up and see Asgard until it comes crashing down on you. But, it's the price you pay.
Okay, so before we move on, I've also got a secret question for you.
Oh, okay, bring it.
You said this is where things come to die. This is a cursed trip for Steve. Okay, bear in mind that the only reason this comes about is because my wife and I, literally every time we go out of town for, any further than an hour away for any kind of trip, especially if it's an overnight trip, something happens.
Oh, no.
And it's almost always on her side of the family. Somebody goes into the hospital. Somebody dies. Somebody got in a wreck. Something, So it's like every time we go on a trip, there's a curse. So my secret question to you is, do you have such a thing as cursed trips?
Oh, Yeah, I don't have cursed trips. I have a weird thing in my life where professionally, when I'm like working towards or almost at the advent of like a major professional moment, like a project I've been working on for years or something super high profile or high stakes, something always happens in my family. Like somebody gets sick or something, you know, like there's always something. So I have a little bit of that. I don't have cursed trips, but I do have sort of cursed professional success. Like in order to move forward in my professional life, someone has to die. So
what you're saying is your career arc is basically the plot of Highlander.
Yeah, basically, yeah. Actually, there can only be one, man. There really can be. And, you know, and look, I've come to grips with it. You know, I just, you know, I got a lot of family members.
Okay, so while we're here, one more question. Because I can't leave Oklahoma yet, because God, when is that going to happen in comics again? Really?
Yeah.
Okay. So Steve is, you know, talking about mountains in a piece of fiction. My question to you, what is your favorite mountain in fiction?
Oh.
Or use of a mountain in fiction? It can be a real mountain or a fictional mountain.
That's a really good question. I mean, you know, there are some, you know, Mount Doom, like there's some big ones that jump, you know, from Lord of the Rings or going through the Misty Mountains, you know, of the trolls. And though, you know, that jumps to mind quickly. But I think, God, that's a really, really good question. I feel like, did Skeletor live in a mountain in He-Man?
Yes.
Okay. I knew you would know that. Yeah, that's got to be my favorite. I loved He-Man was, I mean, like all kids, you know, grew up on He-Man and I enjoyed it. It wasn't like my favorite cartoon. Like, I know the lore of He-Man has gone on and there's like comics and there's all this other stuff, and that's great, you know, but I one of the things I did like about He-Man was the like dark undercurrent of like swamps. Like the settings were dark, Castle Grayskull, and then, you know, Skeletor's cavernous, you know, mountainous headquarters too. So yeah, I'm gonna go with that. What about you?
Yeah, I was also gonna go with Snake Mountain.
Oh my God, did I really steal your... I forgot it was called Snake Mountain.
But I can also jump over to Transformers, because their ship crashes in the base of a, you know, a bit of a mountain. It's a volcano, technically, but...
That's awesome. And remember the JLA, their first headquarters, with Happy Harbor, was in a mountain. And then the Detroit League goes there to die. Unlike Oklahoma, they go there.
That was a good question. The Detroit League lives forever.
I know. You, me, and Shag, man. So back to the comic book, we get Diana. We cut back to Diana, and she is, I mean, this is Quest 101. This is like the best D&D campaign ever. Diana's faced with two paths. I mean, literally, sort of two dark tunnels, and she doesn't know which one to choose to go next. And she, the one she chooses has these sort of grotesque sounds coming from them and these grotesque shapes. She sees this whirlpool, and it's all of these, it's seemingly these souls of these Amazon warriors who yell to her, "We're your sisters who fell protecting, you know, the entrance to this dark pit." And we know that that is true, because even in the first issue, when the Amazons are sent to Themyscira, the gods say to them, "Hey, this is a gilded cage, basically. Like, yes, it's beautiful here. Yes, you'll live forever. But part of the penance of going here," and penance for what is disgusting, but part of the penance of going here is you're protecting the world from the evil that lurks below it, and many lives will, you know, many Bothan spies will die in order to keep that cavern closed. So this is a really nice touch. I love that Perez and Wayne are going back to this and basically saying, "Hey, we had this plot thread of what was under the island. We're going back to that in our second arc, but also we're not going to leave these poor women who died defending it hanging." So we see these souls, and then we see, and this is a Brett Young. So Brett Young is a host of the Fantastic Four on the network, and he's just one of the funniest people on the planet. And in the feedback for every episode of this show, he talks about how morally corrupt Julia Capitellis is, and that she's basically using Diana to quote, "wet her beak," which is the funniest thing of all time. And so he just goes off on Julia all the time. So Diana sees an image of Julia in the spider web. So we now know who the silhouette was. And she's, you know, being attacked or seemingly dying. And Diana rushes to save her. But it's all an illusion. It's a trap by Echidna, who's the mother of demons. So Diana's gonna is on to her next fight. We've seen the Hydra. She's now gonna fight Echidna, which is
a quick question, and it's, you know, not a secret question or anything, but earlier, you know, speaking of Julia, like way earlier in the issue, Diana mentions, you know, all the Greek monsters and stuff, and she learned about them from Julia.
Yeah, I had that.
She has an island full of Amazons who know about these things, and she learned them from Miss I teach at the university.
Yeah, I had the exact same moment. She says, oh, I know from Julia's books not to cut the Hydra's heads off because they'll grow back. And I'm like, wait, what do you mean you know from Julia's books? You mean you know from your own history? Like, yeah, that was a weird choice, and it did throw me for a second. So, I guess if you really want to read into it, Perez is saying that, you know, humans have added these layers to mythology over the years. That's all well and good. I didn't need a Julia moment there either. So, I get the feeling
like, you know, Diana's 3 years old and everybody's like alpha, beta, gamma, delta, don't cut the head off a Hydra.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah, Julia's a funny character. I like her because she's like a motherly mentor figure to Diana, not to her own child. Like, I wouldn't want to be raised by Julia Capitellas, but I wouldn't mind, you know, being befriended by her if I came to man's world. So
I'd like to borrow one of her 17 houses.
Oh, my God. Which are not far from each other either. Though I know Ward Hill Terry will write into this episode and tell us exactly where her winter home must have been located in Boston, which is, again, one of my favorite things in the feedback. So Diana's fighting Echidna. And we cut to Hippolyta, who has a intense staring contest with a vulture, realizes the vulture's communicating to her, hey, stop being a queen and following the gods and go help your daughter. She takes off her queenly garb, puts the crown down, basically says, I'm not queen anymore, and rides to the entrance of the pit under Paradise Island. Her general, best friend, and potentially lover, depending on which in different future storylines, Philippus, sees her doing this and is like, no. My queen cannot endanger herself. She's also endangering all of us, you know, risking the wrath of the gods. So she confronts her on the beach in front of the entrance to the cavern, and they have a pretty intense fight, both of them believing that they are right, both of them really believing that they're doing the right thing. So this brings me to a secret question. Do you have a favorite fight between friends or between two good characters, noble characters, in any medium, where both characters are in the right?
Both characters are in the right. Okay, I have one comic-related and one not comic-related.
Okay, go ahead.
Not comic-related, I'm going to go with the fight in the alley from They Live.
Timmy. You
know, yeah, you know, no. Well, yeah, what gets used for the...
For South Park, yeah,
the Timmy and Jimmy fight, but yeah, the Rowdy Roddy Piper and Keith David fight, because they're both, you know, they're both technically right,
yeah,
but it's the fact that it just drags on for like 5 solid minutes of the movie.
Oh, it's the best fight scene ever. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
but I'm also gonna go with the fight between Leonardo and Raphael in the animated TMNT movie.
Oh.
Because they have a showdown. Raphael has been crime fighting in costume. You know, Leonardo's been gone for a year. He comes back, tries to help, you know, restore order with everybody. And he wants to get this vigilante. Well, you know, he finally encounters him. And of course, you know, it's Raphael. And they finally have it out. You know, just a year's worth of aggression between the two of them. You know, Leonardo's in the right because he wants Raphael to calm down and quit being a vigilante, return to his roots. At the same time, Raphael is right because he wants Leonardo to quit acting like Mother Duck.
Yeah.
And to top it all off, if you've never seen it, even though Raphael lets his anger get the better of him because, you know, got to stay on point, he actually technically wins and loses. You know, he wins the fight, but he loses the moral battle.
Yeah.
So it's wonderful to watch. And again, both characters are technically in the right from their own point of view.
That's a good answer. I haven't seen that movie in a really long time. That's a really good answer. I have a weird one. It kind of fits, kind of doesn't, but it's the first thing that I thought of. And it's Fantastic Four, the Byrne era, we get Secret Wars happens, and the Thing is with Alicia before Secret Wars, though it does seem like that relationship terminates before he goes. And peace amicably, he goes off to Battleworld with Fantastic Four minus Sue, and then doesn't return from Battleworld, because on Battleworld he discovers he can turn back and forth to Ben Grimm at will, and he wants to kind of be Rocky Grimm Space Ranger. And while on Battleworld, people forget this, falls in love with a woman and has a full-on relationship. And then while that's happening, Johnny and Alicia back home bond and fall in love. Ben gets back, and they have this massive blowout. And it's an interesting one. It's a messy one, because technically, Johnny has every right to be pissed, because Ben and Alicia are not together. Alicia is her own person. She has a right to make her own choices. You know, actually, if anybody should be mad, it's Alicia. And then Ben has a right to be mad, because while all of that is true, dude, bro code. Like, you don't date your best friend's ex, any ex, even if it was like a weekend fling of an ex, much less his big ex, much less the, like, the one, her name is literally, legally, Alicia Masters, Ben Grimm's girlfriend, you know, like, so, and I know it gets wiped away, you know, with the laser fist, the Elijah laser fist of it all, but it's still something where both are in the right and both are in the wrong. And then I'm going to go, this might be controversial, but I'm going to go to Civil War, the comic book version of it. And it's Iron Man and Captain America, Tony and Steve. The comic depicts Steve as the hero. Steve is the one in the right in this, in bucking the government and saying, no, you know, we won't tell you our secret identities. We won't work for the government. But Tony's not wrong. Like, these are basically weapons of mass destruction. And the people of the country have a right to have some safeguards, right? Like, they have a right to know that, you know, there are some protections and training and stuff in place. So both of those characters are sort of in the right in that moment. So, all right. So Philippus is trying to stop Hippolyta. It's to no avail. It's a brutal fight, but Hippolyta is ultimately victorious, puts Philippus on a horse, sends her back to the Amazons, and runs into the cavern to help Diana. Now, all of this is being watched by Pan, who's like, uh-oh, this is going to interfere with my plans for the Amazons and the gods. And you realize, oh, okay, something's going on here. Well, the Millennium Banner on the front kind of, you know, tells you what's happening here. So Clinton, brings me to my next secret question. Millennium was a crossover in the late 80s, 1988, written by Steve Englehart, drawn by Joe Staton, coming out of the Green Lantern and Green Lantern Corps book, where the Guardians of the Universe had a police force prior to the Green Lanterns, the Manhunters, and they were these robots, and they patrolled the universe, but they eventually became fascist dictators, and the Guardians had to put them down. Well, what the Guardians didn't know is the Manhunters had gone sort of underground, and they had infiltrated everything, literally in every time, including the Legion. And so you had people, characters, the whole spin of Millennium was you didn't know who was secretly a Manhunter. Black Canary could be one, Captain Atom could be one, or Rocket Red number 7, who's had one line of dialogue and has appeared in one issue. Gee, I wonder which of the three it's going to be. But anyway, some, you know, decent-sized characters turned out to be Manhunters. So, Clinton, did you have a favorite reveal of a character as a Manhunter from Millennium?
Oh, does anybody have a favorite reveal?
I do, of characters, actually.
Really?
I do.
That is a good, good question.
You want me to go first?
Yes, please okay. Do.
So I actually have two. I'll just do one for now in case the other one might be one that you use. But there is the Outsiders series, which is brilliantly covered by the Outcasters podcast, Tim Price on the Right On Network. And the Outsiders is one of my favorite teams ever. Batman and the Outsiders was a great book. But the Outsiders comic is sort of winding down when Millennium hits. It's coming to an end. And their big reveal right at the end of that series, it sort of destroys the team, is that their scientist, the lead scientist from Markovia, who had given Geo-Force and Terra their powers, Dr. Helga Jace, was in fact a Manhunter the whole time. And it's a really elegant reveal in a way, because it begs the question that whole series, they never zero in on it too much. But as a comic book fan, I would read that series and go, wait a minute, this random scientist discovered a way to give people, like, you know, Terrakinesis? Like basically she created two of the most powerful characters in the DC universe with science, with capital S science, and she's not just replicating that for Markovia and making them the most powerful nation in the world. Like, what has happened here? And so there was always that question in the back of your mind. And then there was one other giant clue. Well, two. One, she was a relatively ruthless character at times. Like, she would sort of preference science over humanity. So there was always a little bit of a hint of that. And then three, the biggest clue, her first name was Helga. And anybody named Helga is evil. I mean, that's just, you know, we've just known that. We've known that since the dawn of time. It's in our DNA. So Helga Jace, Dr. Jace from The Outsiders would be my big reveal. What about you?
I will probably have to go with Laurel Kent. Just because it's so bonkers.
It's a great choice.
You know, to the fact that, you know, you have a 30th century character who, for really no other reason than, haha, gotcha, is revealed as a manhunter. I do have a least favorite, though.
Oh, what's that?
It's always been Lana Lang.
Oh, yeah.
Even though she was technically, you know, mind controlled, it wasn't android clone. Like,
yeah, they didn't go so far as, yeah, to make her an actual manhunter. They made her mind controlled. But yeah, that one's, LeBurn doesn't exactly nail that one. I don't love that one either. I want to talk about Laurel Kent quickly, because for those who don't know, Laurel Kent is, when introduced, the 30th century ancestor of Clark Kent, a Superman. And she is introduced when Superboy is flying around, sees her, and is like, oh, that chick's really hot, because Laurel Kent is naked all the time, except her choice of clothing is like this shadow wear. It's these shadows that just move around her parts and cover the least amount of them. So she's effectively naked all the time. Or
well, she has the cape-esque poncho.
She's naked and just wears a big red poncho with a Superman symbol on it. So Laurel Kent is the only power she inherited from her ancestors. She's invulnerable. And Legion of Superheroes Annual 1 is who shot Laurel Kent. Someone shoots her and they go on a quest to find out. But Laurel doesn't really get much development as a character. So post-crisis, when Millennium hits, Laurel Kent's just hanging out there like a big, like, what? You know, crisis was supposed to wipe away all of this kind of stuff. So they've got to do something with her anyway. But the thing I love about it, what Levitz does and Greg LaRocque, is they don't just make her a manhunter to clean up a post-crisis problem and to make a somewhat well-known character a manhunter. They have her date Sunboy first, and they do it to screw him over, which is so awesome because he's the worst character ever in that run. Well, 5 years later, he's not great either, but he's the worst character. He's vapid. He's this himbo. And I love the fact that both he and Clint Barton, Hawkeye from The Avengers, have slept with evil robots disguised as women. Because Hawkeye slept with a Doombot pretending to be the Scarlet Witch. So, you know, perils of being a superhero. So I love that connection between the two of them. So Diana's fighting Echidna in the cavern, defeats her pretty readily, actually, considering, again, Echidna is kind of a big name in Greek mythology, and Diana's beaten the Hydra and Echidna not too difficultly. The difficulty level wasn't too high. And Diana, after beating Echidna, has to find her way out of this cavern. She realizes the only way through is down, basically, and she flies through this like supernatural storm. She's suddenly in the ocean, though not drowning, and she sees a plane wreck at the bottom of the sea, and it reminds her of, from issue 2 of the series, Steve Trevor's plane wreck. And she's like, oh, is this Steve's plane? But she looks at it closely and she's like, no, it's not actually. That's weird. She emerges from the water onto Paradise Island and she's kind of wondering. She's got the rest of the plane. She kind of sees some of it. And she's looking at it and she's like, no, this isn't Steve's plane. This is much too small. But and yet it's another, you know, American warplane on Paradise Island. What's happening? And she hears a voice and she looks up. And she sees this beautiful woman in Themyscira armor, very evocative of the Wonder Woman costume. And the woman says, I am the woman for whom you were named, the warrior for whom you were named. I am Diana. So it ends on a splash page, and it ends on a really cool note in particular, because at the start of the Challenge of the Gods, Apollo and the gods who are friendly to Diana said to her, hey, we're going to have you undertake these challenges, but really the goal of this is for you to find your destiny and learn your history, basically. Learn who you truly are. So Paris and Ween, one of the things I love about them in this book is they seed things. They're not it's not Chris Claremont seeding. It's not like I'm going to drop a seed, remember I dropped it and come back to it 20 years later, which I love. I love Chris Claremont. But it's really more of a like, hey, we're going to plant a bunch of seeds in issue one and two of this book, and then we're going to pay them off about a year later, which is nice. And, you know, one of those seeds is, in order to become Wonder Woman, she's got to do the flashing thunder test, which is a gun being fired at her at the magic bracelets. Well, where the hell did a gun come from on Paradise Island? Why does she have the American flag as a motif in her costume? So there's a bunch of unanswered questions, and this arc is going to answer them, which is really exciting. So I like that ending. It's not maybe the most exciting thing. It's not ending on the Hydra, but like as a reader, did it pull you in? Did it make you want to learn more?
Oh, absolutely. And it also leads into one more secret question.
Oh my God. Okay. You really bring in the heat this episode.
Okay. So we end on a cliffhanger, you know, obviously, but it also is the dramatic reveal of someone here to help our hero. So do you have a favorite moment similar to this, you know, the dramatic return, the, you know, hero approaches to help our main character kind of thing?
Oh God. Okay. I have a couple that are coming to mind. One is obvious because it's the greatest sudden reveal of support in all of nerddom, which is you're all clear, kid. It's, you know, it's the trench run, Luke Skywalker, Darth Vader's all up on him. And then Han Solo comes in the Millennium Falcon and bats Vader away. And so there's that moment, which is amazing. I love the moment in Infinite Crisis where the Titans are fighting Superboy Prime, who's awful. And he's just smacked Panther's head away. You know, like he's batted it like a badminton, like a shuttlecock. He's just smacked it away. He's just torn Risk, if anybody remembers Risk with a Q. He's just torn his arm off. He's just decimating the Titans. And Impulse and Wally come running in, and they're going to take Superboy Prime into the Speed Force. This is the answer to how to defeat him. But they kind of can't do it alone. And then Barry Allen suddenly sort of comes like out of time. This is before his return in Final Crisis. He returns three times before Final Crisis. He sort of comes running out of time, and he lends his speed to them in order to be able to do this thing to temporarily defeat Superboy Prime. And Bart, in this great moment, looks up and goes, "Grandpa?" And it's this – I mean, it's a total – it's like it's such a beautifully layered moment by Jeff Johns and George Perez and Phil Jimenez and Jerry Ordway, because it's one, the momentary return of a beloved hero in Barry Allen, but two, you're reminded that Barry's more than just the Flash, the second Flash, that he's, you know, family, and that for Bart, this is his grandpa who helped raise him. And so it's just a sweet moment. It's probably my favorite moment in that mini. Yeah, I love it. What about you?
Oh man, that is a great choice. I've got a couple. Your daughter reads manga.
Oh yeah,
best I remember. Has she read Berserk at all?
Yeah, she's typical teenager. If it's popular, she's kind of been like, I don't know if I'm going to go read that. And I'm like, stop doing that. That's lame. You're going to miss out on cool stuff. And so she just started reading Berserker. Yes.
Okay. So at one point, the main character Guts, you know, he's a mercenary for hire, goes along with this mercenary band for several years, finally realizes that he can't grow as a person just staying there doing everything with them. He goes away for a year. Everything for the Band of the Hawk goes to complete crap without him there. I mean, their leader gets put in prison. You know, the new lady has to take over as leader. They just keep losing battle after battle, you know, dwindling down their outlaws now. And he finally hears about them nearby and rushes off to see his friends again.
Oh, nice.
It gets to the point, you know, like there's a surprise attack on them. They're all exhausted, just beat down. Nothing's going right. Their leader, Casca, is like right at sword point, not on the ground. And next thing you know, Guts just swings his sword, you know, takes out the guy, stands there very hero-like, and just looks down at her and says, "Look alive, Commander."
Oh, nice. Nice.
And it's like the, you know, it's kind of like Gandalf coming over the hill on the third day. But the one that has stuck with me for 40 years at this point, And this is where Rob Kelly can tune out for a minute or two, because I'm going to talk about boxes.
Oh, boxes.
Mm-hmm. In Transformers, there is a point where there is a battle. It takes too long to relate the whole plot. But anyway, for everybody that knows Transformers, the Aerobots have formed into Superion, Stunicons have formed into Minasaur, the Constructicons have formed into Devastator, and they are just beating the ever-living crap out of Superion. And I mean, like, as a five-year-old, you're thinking, this is it. This is where a Transformer just dies on screen. Little did we know the movie was coming.
I was going to say, hold on to that thought, kid.
Yeah. And then, like, out of nowhere, Omega Supreme shows up. Bear in mind, the previous episode, Omega Supreme had blown up and they were constantly working on repairs. You didn't think this dude was going to show up.
Uh-huh.
You know, because you're five and your toys are fighting each other. This is real serious stuff.
That's awesome. So, that is awesome.
It was important enough that it left an impression on me.
Oh, yeah. But,
you know.
Yeah.
I am neither smart nor wise. So
look, those moments, man, they you know, they're primal. They imprint on you. So yeah, I that's a great question, and great examples too. I love boxes talking to boxes. The first time I heard Rob refer to Transformers as boxes talking to other boxes, I died. I was like, oh my God, that's the funniest thing I've ever heard. So Clinton, we've come to the end of the issue. Let's talk about, do you have a favorite image or panel from the issue that you think is the best sort of piece of art by Perez and Patterson?
You and I are going to pick the same one, I know. It's the splash page at the end.
Yeah.
How can it not be? But if I'm going to argue something else, it would be the two-page spread where Diana fights the Hydra. I know you're like, it's van art. Well, yeah, it is. But it's also the same thing I would have had as a poster when I was 10.
Oh, yeah. No, I love it. For me, it's that splash page as well. I mean, there are some great other moments. There's some great close-ups of Diana's face that, you know, clearly Perez draws. And again, Patterson's amazing. But that the majesty of this unknown warrior standing there telling Diana basically like, I'm here. You're named after me. I'm here to tell you who you are. Like, that's really powerful and sums up sort of the whole point of this arc. So it's a really fun second part. A lot happens, man. This is definitely, there's no decompression in this comic. We go from Hydra to Echidna to Diana, original Diana to Oklahoma. I mean, you know, we cover all the bases. So it's a really great issue, but not quite the end of the episode, because every episode ends with a little segment I like to call Bringing Peace to Man's World, in which the guest and I put forward an idea that we think, big or small, fun, serious, or silly, would bring a little bit of peace to the world. So you're the guest, Clinton, so I want you to have the final word. So I'm going to go first. And this is small, but one way that I would bring a little peace to man's world has to do with an experience that all of us have, which is waiting on hold. And we all wait on hold for pharmacies, doctor's offices, insurance companies, cable companies. It's a universally a horrible experience. And in the last few years in particular, in place of hold music, we often have AI voices coming on telling us, you know, we're experiencing a larger, you know, volume of calls than usual. Please hold on the line. And did you know that you can, like, just all these voices. And so I was on hold the other day and I was getting all those same messages from the same AI voice. And I thought for a minute, how cool would it be if you could pick your own AI voice for when you're on hold? Universal choice. Like, there's a place you go online and you say, from now on, when I'm on hold, I want it to be Jessica Rabbit telling me that they're experiencing a higher volume of calls. Or I want Hawkeye Pierce sarcastically telling me that my call is important to them. Like, it would be so cool if you could choose a voice that, you know, is more interesting or brings you comfort. Or to go even further, if you could upload an audio recording and they could, you know, do some AI magic and make that the voice. Like, imagine if you could get a recording of your mom's voice and you upload it. And from here on out, when you're waiting online in, you know, on hold, and they're like, you know, the doctor's office will be with you in just a moment, it's your mom going, oh, sweetie, it'll be okay. And I'm proud of you for going to the doctor. And I'm glad you're getting that thing checked out finally. Like, so I just think we would all feel a little more peaceful and a little less stressful if we could dictate the voice on the other end of the line via AI. So that's how I'd bring a little peace to man's world. What about you?
I like that idea. Okay, so this is the answer that has been so very obvious to me since you dared agree let me be on this show. First of all, for everybody who knows us, knows that you and I have, you know, a certain type of relationship.
You want to expand on that, buddy?
Yeah, you know. Sean buys you dinner. He brings you flip. No.
I'm a gentleman.
No, Sean, what I'm proposing is that everyone needs their own go-to Jew. And no, not necessarily, you know, someone who is Jewish. I feel that everyone needs someone from a particular background, be it religious, ethnic, you know, socioeconomical, any sort of thing like that, that they are comfortable asking questions and the person can give them honest answers. You know, do you understand Hanukkah? No, you don't. So you go to your go-to Jew and you say, Sean, explain Hanukkah to me.
This is awesome.
Because, you know, all I ever hear is, it's Jewish Christmas. And when you, which point you reply, well, it kind of is, but it's not.
Yeah, no.
Because, you know, and you lay out the reasons.
Yeah.
Something like that. You know, just, I feel there would be a lot less confusion, a lot less, I don't know, people getting offended over a lot of things. Just be, you know, have somebody you can talk to and be willing to talk with them about things.
This is a brilliant idea, actually. I knew when I saw it in the notes, you literally just put the thing I've been waiting for, you know, and I was like, oh, okay, it's going to be the go-to Jew thing. And again, for those of you listening, you know, Clinton is so sweet. Like, he will literally just reach out to me and be like, hey, this holiday's coming up. What is it? And I'll be like, oh, it's this, you know, and I love it. I love one that he's interested and then he reaches out. And I, you know, I think for you, like, I'm a safe space. You know, I'm never going to be like, oh, or, you know, weird or judgy. I always think it's really cool. I love that idea of everyone having a safe space to go to say, like, hey, I don't really understand Zoroastrianism. You know, you're a Zoroastrianist. Tell me about your religion. Or, you know, hey, I've never been to this country. Tell me about your culture and your people. And I love the idea of all of us having safe spaces for those conversations, because you're right. It would make the world such a better place. Like, so much of, I don't know, racism and ignorance and misunderstandings and distrust come from a lack of communication and a lack of understanding. And that lack of communication and understanding often comes from fear. And if that fear were gone because you could talk to somebody, then that would solve. Clinton, you may have just fixed the world, man. That was really good. That's really good. Well,
I mean, it just makes sense to me. Like, I don't know much about anything sometimes. I don't want to be ignorant and be like, well, you know, the reason they have a breast is...
The go-to Jew thing is so funny because it started out as a thing with you and me over the years. And then so many other people picked it up to the point where, like, where Ryan Daly had me co-host on the Cheers episode where Lilith and Frasier get their kids bris, where they get their kids circumcised. And I'm like, really? And he's like, yeah. He's like, you're the go-to Jew. And I was like, oh, dude, okay. I'm like, this is great. It's spread out amongst others. No, that's a great idea, man. Look, the Fire & Water Podcast Network has a history of manifesting some really cool stuff, right? Like, somebody on the network will start a show, and like Rob starts Treasury Cast, right? Treasuries have not existed for decades. They were a, you know, oversized print version of comics that were popular in the late 70s, early 80s. Rob starts this show. All of a sudden, treasuries are back with a vengeance, right? Like, I mean, like all these different things that this network has manifested. I have a secret little belief that at some point somebody's going to find like the archives of this show, and they may not give a damn about Wonder Woman, but they're going to listen to this segment on for every episode, and they're going to go, oh, legitimately, the people on this show, the guests, just laid out how to fix the world. and like all of these things will come about and will be adopted, and the world will be in a better place. And yours, man, chief amongst them, that's a great suggestion. So Clinton, thank you so much for joining me. I mean, you can, you know, I think listeners can tell we always have a really good time recording together. I'm super excited that you were on the show, and you brought the heat, man. You brought great secret questions. Why don't you tell listeners where they can find you?
Okay. So for people who are totally not annoyed by my voice by now, you can find me on a plethora of podcasts. I suppose plethora works when there's like four.
Yeah, you've got quite a few. There's quite a few, man.
For the most part, you can find me on my main show, which is Coffee and Comics, where I look at basically a random comic or comics related media, hopefully in the span of time it takes to have a nice little coffee break. I have another show, which is kind of at random, called Days of High Adventure, which focuses on sword and sorcery and fantasy comics. Over on the Longbox Crusade Network, I do Fan Film Fridays, which you have been a guest on several times.
I think I might have claim to most guests on that spots on that show, actually.
There's a decent chance.
Yeah, there's an outside chance I'm top one or two as guests on that show.
Yeah, we're, you know, I and a guest look at online fan films. It's just basically a fun little discussion about things that a lot of people have never seen, some never even knew existed. And believe me, it runs the gamut from,
yeah, it does.
Let's see, adaptations of 24 Hour Diner, gay Sherlock Holmes.
Which is the cutest fan film ever made. The queer Sherlock Holmes, I cannot recommend enough.
The celebrities who could not go to paying acting gigs, getting together for charity and remaking The Princess Bride. Like 5 seconds at a time. And those are just some that Sean's been on.
Yeah, I was going to say, those are just mine.
You know, that doesn't include, you know, Superman fan films that rival big budget productions or, gosh, not Shakespeare, Sherlock Holmes that you wouldn't believe wasn't done by the BBC.
Mm-hmm.
Or Italian X-Men that...
That was mine, too.
Yeah, that might be diminishing returns, but you also have to take into consideration the time it was made.
It was really good. It was fun.
It's fun. It's not going to be, you know, amazing big budget thing, but it's also from...
It holds up as well as X-Men 2000. I mean, it's pretty on par with that.
Mm-hmm. And you can also find me on Turtle Power Hour with John M. Wilson and Lane, where we look at the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles Adventures comic from Archie and the original Mirage Turtles appearances.
Nice, nice. So, listeners, plenty of places to find Clinton, plenty of awesome shows, really about as wide a range of shows as anybody out in our community. I mean, that's a really wide range of shows. They're all awesome. They're all wonderful. Thank you so much for being here, Clinton. Listeners, we're going to take a podcast promo break. I have to pick which of Clinton's many promos to play, and then I'll be back with listener feedback from our last episode.
Just play them all.
Oh, yeah. Okay. We'll do them all. The back half of this episode will be about an hour. All right. We'll be back in just a moment with listener feedback.
Hey everybody, Clinton Robison here. I recently attempted to sneak into the Longbox Crusade headquarters basement to watch some of the Albrecht Brothers action movies while the crew was out at the Saturday matinee theater. Too bad I had a little mishap and got stuck down here. With no movies to boot! However, there are pieces of Pat's old podcasting equipment and excellent Wi-Fi service. So I decided to pass the time watching online fan films and talking about them. What, you don't know what a fan film is? Well, there are these non-theatrical movies that people post online of already established characters and settings. Ooh. Hey, now. Just wait and see. Save all judgment for what happens when you listen to Fan Film Fridays. A new podcast found on the Longbox Crusade podcast feed.
We are back from that podcast promo break to cover your feedback for Wonder Woman issue 10, which I covered with Max Traver. As always, I encourage you to leave a review on Apple Podcasts or on fireandwaterpodcast.com as it helps folks to find the show. Up first is Martin Gray, and Martin calls me to the carpet for a mistake I made in the episode. During my Lasso of Truth moment, I tell a really funny story of a former student who referred to communion wafers as Jesus. And in the story, I'm talking about how I'm explaining communion to my students in a scholarly way, and I refer to transubstantiation, the transformation of body into blood, you know, this is my body, this is my blood, as transmogrification. And Martin and Super Captain and a bunch of other folks write in and are like, hey, Sean, you got the word wrong. And what's really, really funny about this is, one, I knew the right word, and when I used to teach it, I taught the right word. But since I taught this, it was part of my Dante's Inferno unit, since I taught it, I've played a ton of D&D. And there is a term in D&D called transmogrification, where you shapeshift into something else. And because I'm a giant nerd, the words just interspliced and I used the wrong one. And I appreciate you guys correcting me. And I am super nerdly, awesomely embarrassed about my mistake. But, you know, it goes back to D&D, so it's a good thing. Greg Baker writes in next saying, another great episode. I'm glad there was a comment on the cover. As I said before, the Gatefold has my vote as the single best Wonder Woman cover ever, pointing out not just the artistic layout, but also the subtext and foreshadowing that it delivers makes it even greater. I also really appreciated the nod to the new Teen Titans issue featuring the Clash of the Titans. Currently doing a chronological reread of my DC Comics collection, and I just landed on September of 1981, so perfect timing. It was neat to compare George Perez's take on the Greek gods between 1981 and 1987. That is so cool, Greg. A complete reread of your comics is awesome. And I love, I mean, obviously, I love Perez, so I love New Teen Titans. And I also actually really enjoy side-by-siding Perez's early, mid, and later career work. And, I mean, all of it's amazing, but it's fun to see the differences. And New Teen Titans in particular is my favorite because he's inked by Romeo Tangal, who I think is the best inker for George. But, you know, opinions may vary. Bucky749 writes in next with a secret question saying, or asking rather, would you rather see a team-up story about a Wonder Woman who works for a female trucker who is a known CB superhero and her handle is Wonder Woman, or a world where Wonder Woman is a Japanese superhero drawing her power from the Japanese mythology and being a kind of magical girl type manga? Bucky, that is an awesome question. In a proper world, I should say, the manga-inspired story, because that would be great. But there's no way I'm passing up a trucker Wonder Woman story. I mean, how awesome would that be? As somebody who has every issue of US 1, I would love a Wonder Woman trucker series with an orangutan, of course. Up next is a comment from Ian Miller, also from fireandwaterpodcast.com. Ian says, loved the secret question of what do you wish a hero had been talked out of? My answer, naturally, is I wish someone had talked Bruce out of firing Stephanie Brown as Robin in 2005. So many good stories lost with their dynamic. Grim Detective and Sassy Squire. I love Sassy Squire. Just because Stephanie did the same thing Tim, Jason, and Dick did before her. Curse the stubbornness of DC editorial. I'm right there with you, Ian. I love Stephanie Brown. She's one of my favorite characters ever. That Batgirl run by Brian Q. Miller is one of my favorite runs. And she would have been a great Robin. She was not given a chance. It very much read like she was set up to fail. I totally agree with you. I wish they had given her a longer runway. Previous guest Dr. Andrew writes in to add his thoughts to some secret questions, saying, as for secret questions, things I realized were dark that I didn't understand as a kid. Obviously, the Ode to Billy Joe is a clearly dark song about suicide, but only when I got older did I piece together that he kills himself over guilt for he and the girl in the song throwing their baby off the bridge. Chilling. He's not the only one to mention this song. I've never heard this song. It was brought up a few times in the feedback, and I don't know if I want to, but it sounds really dark. He says, this question about speaking truth to power. Henry Fonda in 12 Angry Men for sure, Marlon Brando in On the Waterfront. I totally agree with Henry Fonda. I love 12 Angry Men. I love the story. I love the movie. I used to show it to my kids and when I was in the classroom. It's amazing. As for what a character should have been talked out of, obviously Donna Troy marrying Terry Long. I was right there, Donna. That's awesome, Dr. Angie. All of men of a certain age, all of us, really, really don't understand the Terry Long marriage and really would punch space and time to make it not have happened. And he closes by saying, but maybe Dr. Manhattan killing Rorschach at the end of Watchmen is a better decision to talk someone out of. I wonder what would have happened had Rorschach made it back. Of course, the journal being on the last page hints at that sort of thing happening anyway. That's a great point. Network All-Star Chris Franklin also chimes in saying, as for something that is far darker than I realized when I was a kid, well, Casper the Friendly Ghost has to be a kid that died, right? Oh my God, this is the darkest feedback ever. Chris goes on to say, I never even thought of that as a child. It honestly wasn't until Bart Simpson mentioned he has the ghost of Richie, he was the ghost of Richie Rich, that I thought of Casper once being a living, breathing kid. Then the movie went there. Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things where, like, you just have to suspend disbelief and pretend that's not what happened. But Casper's the ghost of Richie Rich is fascinating, actually. That's a cool, that'd be a cool, like, 12-part Harvey Comics crisis story. Super Captain writes in saying, as for decisions that characters needed to be talked out of, someone needed to tell Clark and Lois that under no circumstances is Jor-El allowed to take their young son, John, on a trip into space where he will get trapped on Earth 3, imprisoned by Ultraman, and then come back having aged several years. And while we're at it, Clark, did you really need to walk across America for a year? That was the last Superman story before Flashpoint reset everything for the new 52. Hard agree, Super Captain. I actually am one of the few people who likes a lot of the Bendis Superman run. I think it was some, there were some great new characters that were introduced. It was fun to see Jonathan Kent as sort of founder or founding inspiration of the Legion as a superhero, Superboy kind of figure. But aging him, weirdly, my problem is not with the aging of John Kent. It is with the mechanism. Like you say, it is so dark and it is so contrary to what you think of as a Superman mythos. And then the real problem is the aged John Kent is a super well, I mean, he's a normal, you know, he has issues, you know, like any character does that he struggles with, but like he's really a well-balanced character who makes really good decisions, and anybody who went through what Bendis says he went through, I just don't think would be in that space, at least not right away. So yeah, I agree. And then we don't talk about the Straczynski Superman run. it never happened. Martin Gray joins in on the fun again, responding to a decision he wishes a hero hadn't made. Bad comic decisions, he says. I talked Janet Van Dyne out of marrying her dreamboat, Hank Pym, while he was having a split personality crisis as Yellowjacket. Even the Joe Casey Avengers miniseries years later tried to make sense of it, but couldn't sort out that mess. Yeah, major agree, Martin. I love Jan. She's one of my three favorite Avengers. I actually love Hank, too. He's a great character. Yellowjacket's one of the best costume and name combinations ever, and it is a weird choice, and I'm glad that, like, in the Busick Perez run, they address it as well. So great point. Previous guest Justin Snyder writes in to say, I wish there had been someone to talk Maxwell Lord and Amanda Waller out of tipping from morally gray characters into outright villains. The DC universe lost something when both of them went full villain, including Blue Beetle losing his life. Yeah, I mean, that's a good point, Justin. I love both those characters. Max is not a villain. If you read the JLA, the Wahaha years, he's not the best guy in the world, but he's certainly not somebody who shoots Ted Kord in the head. And then Amanda Waller, I cannot get past her origin in the Secret Origins issue that addressed the Suicide Squad, and then in a later issue of the Ostrander, Luke McDonald, Suicide Squad book, which just gives her so much humanity. And she has this, you know, really tragic life and all these deaths in her family. And she overcomes them to become a woman of real power and authority. And yes, she's morally gray and maybe even worse than that sometimes, but not an outright villain. So yeah, I agree with you. Brett Young, host of the Fantastic Four on this very network, writes in to say, what did I not realize was dark at the time? Pretty much all of Pearl Jam's early stuff. I was in college when they were just getting big, and we used to play 10 on a loop. Alive was an especially grim story behind it of parental trauma. Yeah, big time agree, Brett. We're about the same age. I love Pearl Jam. I love early Pearl Jam. But yeah, every song on 10 and Versus, their second album, is steeped in some sort of tragedy. He again goes on to say, what should a character have been talked out of? About every hero who wears buccaneer boots. You can't just jump around in those things. There's not enough Epsom salts in the world to soothe your dogs after fighting the Masters of Evil wearing a pair of floppy pirate boots. That is amazing, Brett. And I like pirate boots. I guess I'd never thought about it. I like them on the page, but I mean, they're just as impractical as fighting in heels for Black Canary or Batgirl. Tim Price writes in with a really interesting observation, saying, not to overly dwell on this, but Diana being overwhelmed by the Hundred Hands is a recurring image in this series. There was Deimos' snake beard engulfing her, and the Nereids placing healing hands on naked Diana under the water. Now, am I kink-shaming Perez? Heck no. If this was his thing, that was his business, but it is a now frequent enough image for me to notice, and considering how clueless I typically am, that's saying something. Well, you're not clueless at all, Tim, and you are definitely right. The idea of Diana being overwhelmed by something physically is a recurring image in this series. I have a little bit of a different read on it. I actually think it ties back to the origin of the character, the William Moulton Marston and H.G. Peter series from the 40s, where H.G. Peter would very purposely draw Diana or Amazons in chains every issue, them being shackled. People like to focus on that to talk about bondage and make some other points. And those are all valid, but what they forget is Peter would subsequently, in every issue, draw her breaking those chains. And this came from a Margaret Sanger quote about women's liberation, saying basically like childbirth, forced childbirth, and matrimony are shackles for women that need to be broken. And so I think it's maybe Perez playing on that motif a little bit of her being quote unquote chained by these mythological figures and breaking loose. But it's an awesome comment, Tim. It got me thinking for quite a while. And then speaking of really thought-provoking comments, Network All-Star and host of Cheerscast, Ryan Daly, writes in with a really, really fascinating point. He says, as you guys were discussing the way the Olympian gods frequently punish the innocent victims of Zeus's lust and the other's jealousy, I started thinking about our own culture of victim blaming and victim shaming. In my life, the most glaring example, which in retrospect feels as cruel as it was misguided, is how the press and the general public treated Monica Lewinsky during the scandal with Bill Clinton. The press dubbed her a whore and a homewrecker. The late night shows mocked her appearance endlessly. She was a punchline for years, and Sweet Christmas, that is so, so wrong. All the scorn and pettiness directed at Monica should have been aimed at the man who put her in that position. The older man, the married man, her boss, the leader of the free effing world, the guy with all the power, the guy who did wrong, but she suffered for it. It's sickening. Yeah, Ryan, this is a really, really poignant point that all Americans, especially of our age or older, really, really need to take to heart. And it's something that, as I got older, I really looked back at that moment with great shame, realizing like, oh, this was this young girl, impressionistic young girl, and here was the most powerful man in the world who just completely abused that power. And so I think it's a great point, and it's a really important point. You know, Ryan goes on to say that Monica Lewinsky has led a really good life, and she's now an advocate and talks very openly about how happy her life is and how good she's doing, and that's all great. But yeah, as a society, we collectively owe her a massive apology, and more importantly, need to learn that lesson. Well, thank you all again for the feedback, and as always, you can leave more feedback at fireandwaterpodcast.com. Join me next episode, where we will talk about Wonder Woman Volume 2, Issue 12. We will continue the Challenge of the Gods arc, and try to help me bring a little bit of peace to man's world.